Friday, May the 8th, was a relatively easy, relaxing day after 2 days of tension and importance. The morning was rest and desk work, and then at noon, I flew to New York with Roy Lynn, Liz, and Bess. We went to the Carlisle, to that beautiful suite where I always feel that I'm intruding on the apartment of the fairy princess. Jean Kintner, Mrs. Gimble, and Mrs. Wilmot came over to have pictures made for publicity purposes for the New York Gala salute at Madison Square Gardens on May the 28th. And then, just as I was getting all dressed in my white chiffon and made up by Eddie Sands with a high hairdo to go to Il Trovatore at the Metropolitan, in came a weary Linda Bird, fresh from 2 days in 5 states and about 14 speeches every day with her daddy, saying that she just couldn't possibly make it another step, couldn't have her picture made, couldn't go up to the opera. We put off having a picture until the next morning, and we told her just to join us in time for the opera and to skip dinner. And so we arrived at the carriage trade entrance of the Old Met about 7 o'clock, to be met by our host and hostess, Anthony Bliss and Mrs. Bliss. It was my sister Eileen on the stage long, long ago, and I saw her with so much delight. It was sometime in the 40s. And manager Rudolph Bing and Mrs. Bing met me. We went in to a very small private dinner in one of the rooms in the Metropolitan. Mary Lasker was there, and Mr. Lauder Greenway, and Mr. and Mrs. Roger Stevens, the papacita of art in so many respects, Mrs. Bliss's married daughter, only about 19, two young men who had been asked to accompany Linda Bird and Warren Lynn, Nick Negroponte, and Mike Golden. I was seated between the very suave and attractive Mr. Anthony Bliss, who I gather is sort of the godfather and chief patron of the Metropolitan Art Association, and its manager, Mr. Rudolph Bing. Mr. Bliss told me that they were going to be in Georgia on Monday, May the 11th. They'd always been in Georgia for several days in May, and always with the most wonderful public acceptance and great hospitality, which was going to be marred somewhat this year because a great Negro soprano playing one of the leading roles was not being invited to the lovely parties which hostesses of the city give to the opera and all its members. Too bad, because that city, which has such a magnificent record of achievement and a hard row to hoe, will suffer from this ill-advised bit on somebody's part. 15 minutes in the dining room made me understand why the opera house was being abandoned, why the Old Met is going to come down and a new center is going to be built. It wasn't air-conditioned. It was hot as could be. And I, who never mind the heat, was steaming. It was caviar, green turtle soup with sherry, roast beef, and some elegant dessert with wines and champagne. And then we went into the Golden Horseshoe, which is all red velvet and gilt ornaments, rococo, baroque in the extreme, semicircular rows of boxes, and above them, I think, about 4 rows of balconies facing the stage. I remember back in about 1938, when Charles Marsh had given us tickets to come to the Old Met for a Sunday performance, how I had seen on the doors of the boxes the famous names of New York's 400 families, America's 400 families, at least the financial establishment of the day, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Goulds, all the great and important names. Now I could no longer find the names on the doors, but they were still the same little rooms, but the gaslight fixtures were not there anymore. The gilt chairs were, and we seated ourselves to watch Verdi's Il Trovatore. Handsome young Franco Corelli sang the male lead, Gabriella Tucci, the heroine, Regina Resnick, probably the most outstanding part of all, the gypsy, who was the foster mother of the troubadour, and who was herself finally burned at the stake. And Robert Merrill, our old friend, had sung for President Senior of Italy at the White House, played the Duke, who was determined to marry the beautiful young highborn heroine. Linda Bird joined us just as the opera was beginning, and I could see the flags flying just as I can with her father. But I'm too tired to enjoy this. I wish I was home in bed. I'm mad I've got to be here. And I hoped it didn't show as clearly to everybody else as it did to me. The house must have been 90 degrees temperature. The music was magnificent. I love the great roaring anvil chorus against the backdrop of the gypsy fire with the flames rising and the crooked dead trees sheltering the weird company. And then Il Miserere. When they know they're both condemned to death, the magnificent enveloping sadness of that familiar melody grips and enthralls you. And then in the last act, our Nostri Monte, home to our mountains, when they're both wishing they could escape and get back to gypsy freedom. It's one of the ones I remember so fondly from Mother's collection of records. At one of the several intermissions, we went back to have a drink of champagne in the lounge. For a wonder, instead of having champagne, I asked if I could have ginger ale. Ginger ale looks very much like scotch and soda. And so when several newspaper people came up and began to talk to me, I guess I should not have been surprised that later on it was reported I was having a scotch and soda instead of champagne. That'll teach me. But just to show you that pride literally goeth before fall, I had a good time talking to these same reporters about how when I was a very little girl, I had listened to my mother's accumulation of opera records. Madame Schumann-Heink, Francis Alda, Scotty, Simric, Severini, always, always Caruso and more Caruso, Mary Garden, Tetrazzini, and that Verdi had been one of my favorites, Il Trovatore, La Traviata, especially Rigoletto. Well, I was all primed for what happened, feeling very pleased with myself and having a very good time in spite of the 90-degree temperature. I went back into the box, accompanied by Mr. Rudolph Bing. Most of the audience were already down in their seats below, and they began to stand and turn around and sort of wave and give some recognition, and I was waving back at them while Mr. Bing was pushing the chair up underneath me. And unfortunately, I did not hear him explain that perhaps it would be more comfortable if I had an armchair, which was just a few feet behind. As he reached for the armchair, having removed the other chair, I sat down upon the floor. Well, I guess I'm the first lady to sit down on the crimson carpet of the Old Met. My first thought was for poor Jerry, who reached and helped me up. And then for poor Mr. Rudolph Bing, there was nothing to do but laugh, which I did heartily, until finally cute Mrs. Anthony Bliss, who used to be my sister Eileen, laughed with me. It was too much to hope that nobody had seen it. How could anybody miss it? I ought to think I got out light when the rather small headline said the next day, "A wonderful evening, First Lady falls for opera." When the opera was over, I left Liz and Bess to go on about that gay nightlife with Carol Channing and took the girls home with me to the Carlisle. A very exhausted Linda Bird, who hardly had strength to tell me about her wonderful Georgia welcome, as she and Lennon had been cheered by a crowd estimated at 500,000 in Atlanta on Friday during their southern visit, in which Lyndon had very boldly appealed for an end to race barriers, and about how she had made a speech at Everstop, how she had said that several people have already made complaints about my father signing an educational bill, and I am not in school today. I wanted to clarify that point. I thought I was getting a cram course in economics, sociology, history, and geography. Not the least to say physical fitness, trying to keep up with my father. She sounds like she's done a good job from reading the papers. I wanted to get out here today, she said, in Cumberland, and learn not from the books, but from the people. I went to sleep in the Fairy Princess's apartment, thinking that I'll have a very weary husband and daughter for our busy day tomorrow.